imposed a ban on Persian rugs in 2010. After signing a 2015 nuclear deal, the ban was lifted only to be reimposed after Washington unilaterally pulled out of the accord in 2018. That's also around the time when cheap knockoffs of Persian rugs made by Asian countries began flooding the market. Either way, authentic, hand-woven rugs from Iran still hold their place in the market despite roller coaster exports. The industry is gradually bouncing back. According to Iran's Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines and Agriculture, the country still maintains first place in exports of hand-woven carpets worldwide. Based on figures from the National Customs Administration, exports of hand-woven carpets increased to nearly 85% in terms of value in the first 2 months of 2021 alone. According to the National Carpet Center of Iran, last year the country exported some $64 million worth of these items. Also, production went up after the coronavirus pandemic as many craftspeople who had left the sector returned, causing a production jump of around 400%. All right, while I take a quick little break here, I'll be back shortly. Hey everyone, welcome to another special feature of Bazaar. I'm your host Ali Reza, and today we're checking out a knowledge-based company that is saving the country around $20 million worth of imports annually by managing to produce inhaler capsules that we use to import from foreign countries through in-house knowledge, research, and technology. Stay tuned to find out how they did it. Patients with asthma or dyspnea need to use inhalers to get the prescribed drug into their lungs. That requires not just the active substance of the drug, but also a sort of carrier to take the drug into your lungs before it is fully absorbed in your mouth, before it even gets down your trachea. You will find them mixed with the active substance in inhaler capsules that the inhaler punctures once you put the capsule in, which then you inhale. Our journey begins in the storage room where they bring in the raw material, the active substance for these inhaler capsules in the form of tiotropium bromide. Now, this company produces 45 million of these inhaler capsules annually for the 150 to 200,000 patients in the country that are prescribed to use them. And they use not more than 1 kilogram of this active substance, this tiotropium bromide, to make all of these. Now let's check out the production line to see how it's actually made. The raw material in the form of a small amount of tiotropium bromide, as well as the excipients, which would be the aforementioned carriers that mix with the active substance, are then sent to the production line along with the gelatin capsules themselves, which would later be filled with our formulation substance, the mixture of our active substance and the excipients. So before we get into the actual production line, first they bring the raw material from the storage room to allocate to determine what amount of each formulation material they need to bring into the production line. So that includes the active substance, the aforementioned tiotropium bromide, and the excipients, which is the additive substances. So once they've allocated the necessary amount of those, they bring it to the production line, which we will check out now. Perhaps the biggest challenge in this production line is the mixing of an infinitely small amount of active substance with the excipients to get a completely uniform mixture of our formulation substance that you would find inside the capsules. The production line would have to be sensitive enough to mix 18 micrograms of tiotropium bromide with 10 milligrams of excipients in a completely uniform way. 1 microgram, by the way, is 1/1000th of a gram.
There's actually very little substance in it. And that is because the capsule filling machine is capable of microdosing, which after we bring the formulated powder from the previous process, this machine can fill this container, this little capsule, with just 10 milligrams worth of powder, formulated powder, which is not a capability that a lot of capsule filling machines are capable of. So once this capsule is filled with our 10 milligrams worth of formulated substance, we then go to the container filling room.
The containers that have been filled with exactly 30 capsules are brought to be labeled, then packaged, to be sent back into the warehouse, to be sent to pharmacies, and get in the hands of patients. But before that happens, they need to go through one final stage of quality assurance. Because this company has managed to fully domesticize the production technology of this particular product, they're able to save 90% of the currency that would otherwise be spent on procuring this very product for the patients in the country through imports. That is $9 million worth of savings, and they're fully capable of doing that because their production line allows for even leftover for exports. Because of the competitive pricing of the aforementioned tiotropium bromide capsules, the value of the potential exports of this product is estimated to be around $30 million.
And now we're at the quality control lab, and one of the most important quality control procedures that they do is to test the actual performance of the formula and the capsule. So what they do is they use a regular inhaler as a normal patient would. They would insert the capsule in it and use the lung simulator. So they would insert the inhaler, and with the help of a vacuum pump attached to this flow regulator attached to the simulator itself, they simulate the flow of a normal human inhale and see how much of the formula is administered to different stages of the lung. Each of these circles has these holes on them, which gets exponentially smaller the lower you go, to the point that at the bottom you don't really even see any of these holes. The residue left by the formula through this inhale, we test out to see how much of the formula is left on each stage, and then we would see whether the residue left measures up to the amount that we wanted it to, and that pretty much concludes the test, the performance test for our formula. And that also pretty much concludes this episode of Boaz Earth. Take care and bye-bye. For our final portion of the program, let's check out some news and trends in the knowledge-based industries. The activities of knowledge-based companies are not just limited to Iran's borders. They've also headed to Venezuela to kick off a tech and science fair showcasing Iran's latest technological achievements. Nearly 80 Iranian firms participated alongside hundreds of Venezuelan companies in the fair. They offered products and services in numerous fields such as oil, gas, health, pharmaceuticals, agriculture, and machinery. The goal is to exchange experiences, knowledge, and services and deepen Iran's trade ties with the Latin American country. The expo was launched by Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. During the ceremony, Maduro announced that 4 fuel-efficient Iranian car models would be assembled in his country and released into the Venezuelan market. One trend we are seeing these days is the increased activity of biotech companies. In fact, right now, knowledge-based products from this sector hold 40% of the country's total pharmaceutical exports to show for it. That's based on the Association of Manufacturers and Exporters of Medical Biotechnology Products. Biotech refers to the use of living systems and organisms to develop products. According to the association, these products have saved the country millions in foreign exchange. Additionally, these knowledge-based companies have made Iran self-sufficient in biotech production. This sector exports its products to European, Asian, and Latin American countries while competing with other items in the international arena. That covers our program for today. On behalf of the entire Bazaar team, thank you for tuning in and bye for now. Until then.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In Britain, lack of suitable places to house asylum seekers, especially Afghan refugees, could threaten the viability of the British government's illegal migration bill. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The British government was warned recently at a secret crisis meeting in Downing Street. Thousands of Afghan refugees in Britain face homelessness this summer. Council officials told No. 10 Downing Street and Home Office civil servants that about 8,000 Afghan refugees allowed into the country in 2021 under the slogan Operation Warm Welcome are due to be evicted from hotels as early as August because of a government deadline, yet have nowhere to go. The emergency meeting held recently came hours before Prime Minister Rishi Sunak quietly dropped a controversial plank of last year's asylum law that had introduced a two-tier refugee system. Further problems for Rishi Sunak arrived on Sunday, 11th of June, when a parliamentary committee will say his illegal migration bill breaches a number of international human rights obligations and would mean that Britain is turning its back on its vast majority of refugees. In a damning report, the Joint Committee on Human Rights urged the British government to fulfil its role in the global system of refugee protection and not walk away from its legal obligations to refugees, children and victims of modern slavery. During the recent meeting, also attended by a number of Home Office private contractors, officials discussed low-cost options to move up to 50,000 asylum seekers who are in hotel accommodation. However, it became quickly evident that councils would struggle to help because of an acute housing shortage. Pressure on the system is likely to grow further as the number of small boat crossings increases with improved weather conditions. To reduce the number of asylum seekers staying in hotels, which reportedly cost £6 million a day, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak confirmed recently that the government had acquired two more giant barges to house about 1,000 people. The purchase has raised fresh questions over the value for money. The Observer can reveal that the Home Office paid contractor Serco at least £1.5 million to turn a substandard former military base into an asylum seeker reception centre that was never used. MPs and councillors charge ministers with wasting taxpayers' money after the failed attempt to convert RAF Linton on Ouse in North Yorkshire, and said the sum disclosed to the Observer and Liberty investigates after a year-long freedom of information battle could be just a fraction of the true amount spent. The bid to accommodate up to 1,500 asylum seekers at the base in April of 2022 was scrapped less than 4 months later, following fierce opposition and threats of legal action from the local council. Mark Goddard, Linton-on-Ouse Parish Council Chairman, who campaigned against the plan, said the wasted cash was another terrible consequence of what a shambles the whole government and the Home Office in particular are. The Freedom of Information Act response revealed the Home Office paid Serco £1,490,000 for services largely comprising staff costs including recruitment, training and salaries, mobilisation, project management, ground maintenance, inventory, telephony and vehicles. Experts say as problems continue to pile up for the government, the lack of suitable places to house asylum seekers could threaten the viability of the British government's illegal migration bill. The legislation would grant ministers the power to detain and remove anyone arriving in the United Kingdom illegally. Analysis by the Refugee Council indicates that more than 190,000 people could be locked up or forced into destitution during the first 3 years of implementation of the bill. But with capacity already far exceeded, it remains unclear where such huge numbers of refugees could be held. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story and tells us more. A damning report by the Joint Parliamentary Committee on Human Rights warns that if the UK's migration bill is passed in its current form, the country would fail to meet its obligations under international human rights laws. These failures would include denying refugees access to the asylum system and severely restricting human rights claims, denying protection to modern slavery victims, and removing the right of appeal after age assessments. Committee Chair Joanna Cherry queried a claim by Home Secretary Suella Braverman that the bill was compatible with international law. Joanna Cherry said, "We disagree. Having carried out scrutiny of the bill, it is overwhelmingly clear that it breaches a number of the UK's international human rights obligations." Joanna Cherry also questioned the impact on children seeking sanctuary in the United Kingdom. She noted, "The bill falls far short on providing the protection that children need and deserve. If this bill is passed, it is likely to have a disproportionate impact on vulnerable groups." The Home Office said, "The government is committed to ending the expensive use of hotels for asylum seekers, which is why we continue to source new alternative sites and vessels, which are cheaper and more manageable for communities." It added, "The asylum system currently costs more than £3 billion a year, so taxpayers rightly expect the government to find alternative solutions." It added, "We're also taking immediate action to clear the asylum backlog by doubling the number of asylum caseworkers to 2,500 and streamlining interviews and paperwork."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Crossing a new threshold in the type of weaponry supplied to Kiev, the United States on Friday announced it will provide the internationally banned cluster munitions to Ukraine.
In this environment, Ukraine has been requesting cluster munitions in order to defend its own sovereign territory. The cluster munitions that we would provide have dud rates far below what Russia is doing, is providing, not higher than 2.5%.
Sullivan said Ukraine would not be using the munitions in a foreign land. He added that Kiev has provided assurances in writing that the weapons will be used carefully to minimize risks to civilian lives. U.S. President Joe Biden defended the decision, saying it was because the efforts to defend against Russia had run out of ammunition. The move drew an instant reaction from the United Nations.
The Secretary General supports the convention on cluster munitions, which, as you know, was adopted 15 years ago. And he wants countries to abide by the terms of that convention. And so as a result, of course, he does not want there to be continued use of cluster munitions on the battlefield.
A number of key U.S. allies defied Washington's decision to supply cluster munitions to Kiev.
Well, the UK is signatory to a convention which prohibits the production or use of cluster munitions and discourages their use. We will continue to do our part to support Ukraine against Russia's illegal and unprovoked invasion.
Sunak made the comments in an address to reporters. Spain also followed suit, saying that certain weapons and bombs cannot be delivered under any circumstances. France reiterated its opposition to the use of the controversial weapon. Germany said the decision goes against the Convention of Cluster Munitions that bans such weapons on the battlefield. Neither the United States nor Ukraine is party to the pact. Russia strongly condemned the move. In a statement, Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova said it is an act of desperation and shows weakness against the backdrop of the failure of the much-touted Ukrainian counteroffensive. Zakharova added the decision showed the aggressive anti-Russian course taken by the U.S., which is aimed at prolonging the conflict in Ukraine as much as possible. Tehran also lambasted the move. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the U.S. decision to send cluster bombs to Ukraine shows Washington's determination to perpetuate and further complicate the war in Ukraine. Inside the U.S., congressional Democrats raised concerns over the move. Senators Barbara Lee and Tim Kaine said Washington's decision to send cluster bombs to Ukraine could inspire other countries to sidestep an international convention barring such munitions. Supplying Kiev with cluster munitions comes as the armaments are highly controversial weapons that typically release large number of smaller bomblets, which can kill indiscriminately over a wide area. Those that go undetonated potentially endanger civilians for years to come. Cluster munitions are banned by over 100 countries. The supply of such weapons bring Washington's total aid to Ukraine to more than $40 billion since the Ukraine war began in February 2022. In total, the United States and its allies have provided Ukraine with numerous military aid packages worth hundreds of billions of dollars. The military support for Ukraine includes the delivery of heavy and light military weapons and ammunition, as well as non-lethal material military aid. Those weapons are sent to Kiev regardless of the fact that Russia has time and again warned that such a trend would only prolong the conflict and cause more destruction on both sides. But Ukraine allies seem to be more concerned about Kiev's failure on the battlefield and have consequently kept pumping Kiev full of advanced weapons. Those weapons not only have failed to prevent the conflict from getting exacerbated, but instead they have led to even more escalation on both sides. With Ukraine's so-called counteroffensive now it's in second months, Kiev has announced gains during its attacks on Russian forces. Ukraine says a number of villages have been liberated thanks to its counteroffensive. Russia, in the meantime, has targeted positions belonging to Ukraine using missiles, causing death and destruction in several areas. All in all, by supplying Ukraine with the internationally banned cluster munitions, the United States is taking two huge risks. One is simply prolonging the war, as Russia has numerously reiterated. And two is possibly getting Washington involved in the conflict. And that's what many throughout the globe prefer not to pick, given its potential global catastrophic consequences.
The U.S. Treasury Secretary has wrapped up a four-day visit to China with the aim of opening the line of communication and bringing long-running tensions between Washington and Beijing to an end.
A number of issues, including climate and U.S. restrictions on Chinese chip industry, were among topics discussed during the first 2 days of Janet Yellen's visit. But economy and trade co-centered the issues discussed. The U.S. official during the visit said she went to China to deepen communication and work toward a stable and constructive relationship between the two countries.
Amid a complicated global economic outlook, there is a pressing need for the two largest economies to closely communicate and exchange views on our responses to various challenges.
Yellen said, "We believe that it is in the best interest of both countries to make sure that we have direct and clear lines of communication at senior levels." Yellen also took aim at China's planned economy, urging Beijing to turn to more market-oriented practices. She suggested that a shift toward market reforms would be in China's interests. The U.S. Treasury Secretary also held a meeting with Chinese Vice Premier He Lifeng. During the meeting, Yellen said Washington and Beijing must communicate directly when they have concerns about each other's specific economic practices. Yellen noted that the United States and China, the world's two biggest economies, must compete fairly and communicate closely to avoid misunderstandings. Yellen stressed that Washington is not seeking a winner-take-all approach or economic advantage in its relations with Beijing, but wanted to ensure a healthy competition with what she called a fair set of rules that would benefit both countries over time. Yellen's trip is part of a flurry of visits U.S. authorities claim will ease tensions between Washington and Beijing. Last month, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited China and held high-level discussions with Chinese officials, including President Xi Jinping. The two officials agreed that the mutual rivalry should not turn into conflict. The visit came ahead of a possible meeting between U.S. President Joe Biden and President Xi as soon as September's G20 summit in New Delhi. Janet Yellen's visit to China comes as Washington and Beijing are already at odds over a string of issues. Apart from economy and trade, one core still unresolved problem between the two powers is the issue of Taiwan. Tensions over Taiwan have been escalating ever since the United States enhanced its military buildup in the South China Sea in an effort to contain Beijing. After all, China has territorial claims over the self-ruled island and has warned against any move that jeopardizes its sovereignty and territorial integrity. But regardless of those elements, Washington has continued with its collision course with Beijing over the issue of Taiwan. Testimony to that was a trade deal the U.S. struck with Taiwan to deepen economic relations between both sides, a move that sparked a stern warning from Beijing. China strongly lashed out at the U.S., calling on Washington to stop official exchanges with Taiwan under the guise of trade. Other than the trade deal with Taiwan, Washington also held joint massive drills with other countries, including Canada, in the South China Sea, despite repeated warnings from Beijing against any such moves. Not to mention that U.S. vessels have repeatedly sailed through the Taiwan Strait, drawing outrage from China. The recent tensions have prompted Chinese officials to question the U.S. presence in the Asia-Pacific region. Chinese Defense Ministry has called on Washington to pull its military presence away from areas near China. Indeed, the question that arises is that how would the United States react if Chinese destroyers sail through areas close to U.S. borders in the North Atlantic or the North Pacific Oceans, or anywhere near the Gulf of Mexico? Given all such differences, what comes to the spotlight is the aim of Yellen's visit to Beijing and her meeting with Chinese officials. Many believe that the trip will bring no tangible results since the two biggest powers have so far not been able to resolve their most fundamental problems, including the Taiwan issue. What further complicates the situation is the respect the United States does not have for international law when it comes to its own interests. Taking that into consideration, any such trip aimed at easing tensions will be senseless.
The U.S. has made a decision that it will send Ukraine the deadly cluster munitions. The U.S. went on a media blitz to make its case that its decision was justified. From the White House to the Pentagon,
I'm as concerned about the humanitarian circumstance as anybody. But the worst thing for civilians in Ukraine is for Russia to win the war.
To Jake Sullivan, President Joe Biden's national security advisor.
And I'm not going to stand up here and say it is easy. It's a difficult decision. It's a decision we deferred. It's a decision that required a real hard look at the potential harm to civilians.
But are there any doubts about why cluster munitions should not be used and why they are deadly? Cluster bombs carry several hundred bomblets or cluster munitions. Dropped by aircraft or launched from the ground, they're designed to be dispersed over a wide area, which can cover the size of several soccer fields. As they are free-falling, they can strike the ground at a considerable distance from the target area if they are not used correctly. And what makes cluster munitions so controversial is their impact on civilian populations.
The problem with cluster munitions is dud rate. Because these munitions drop large numbers of what are bomblets, depending on how they land, some of them don't go off and will hang around. And that number is anywhere from 2% on up, depending on the terrain. And civilians can happen upon these duds, and they can cause civilian casualties.
According to the International Committee of the Red Cross, up to 40% of cluster bombs result in unexploded rounds or duds, which can cause civilian deaths long after a conflict is over. The Convention on Cluster Munitions is a convention banning the use of cluster bombs and has been joined by more than 120 countries. The U.S., however, is not a signatory to this convention, even though it is a member of the Organization on the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW. Decades after the conflict, they continue to kill. According to the group Handicap International, 98% of cluster bomb victims are civilians, and 27% are children. When the U.S. president was asked why he was providing the cluster munitions now, part of an $800 million security package, he said it was because Ukraine had run out of ammunition.
Mr. President, cluster munitions, why now?
Run out of ammunition.
The Secretary General supports the Convention on Cluster Munitions, which, as you know, was adopted 15 years ago. And he wants countries to abide by the terms of that convention. And so as a result, of course, he does not want there to be continued use of cluster munitions on the battlefield.
The U.S.-backed Saudi war on Yemen, officially still not over. It has resulted in the death of hundreds of thousands. Some of those killed, which were mainly women and children, were a result of cluster munitions, courtesy of the U.S.
Children are the main victim of cluster bombs because the remains of the bombs come into forms of foreign and metallic luster objects and looks like toys. Victims usually lose their eyes and suffer from deformities in their bodies.
Yet, the U.S. use of cluster munitions have not been restricted to Yemen. The U.S. initially used cluster bombs during the invasion of Afghanistan that began in 2001. The U.S. dropped more than 1,500 cluster bombs in that country during the first 3 years of the occupation. It is very telling that not only did the U.S. not have any regard for using these outlawed bombs, but the amounts used showed complete disregard for human lives, particularly for women and children, who are still being murdered to this day. And it doesn't end there. The Biden administration has also agreed to provide Ukraine with depleted uranium shells to equip Abrams tanks that the U.S. is sending there. Britain has already delivered these tanks to Ukraine, equipped with depleted uranium shells. DU munitions developed in the 1970s are not nuclear weapons and do not produce a nuclear explosion, but soldiers or civilians can be exposed to the uranium either in combat or afterward. This was particularly the case in Iraq, when during the U.S. 2003 invasion, heavy use of depleted uranium caused many to die and suffer to this day of diseases which have led to things like birth defects. Instead of searching for a political solution, U.S. and U.K. governments clearly believe that providing DU munitions will improve Ukraine's ability to defeat Russian tanks and bring this conflict to an end. What is even more telling is that the U.S. has said that Ukraine has run out of ammo, in particular the 155mm howitzer, putting into question Ukraine's ability to continue this war. The 155mm howitzer round is one of the most requested artillery munitions of the Ukraine war. The U.S. has already shipped more than 1.5 million rounds to Ukraine, but Kiev is still seeking more. Even though both Russia and Ukraine have been accused of using cluster munitions, which have killed civilians on both sides, The Russian ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, criticized the transfer of these weapons to Ukraine by the U.S. The cruelty and cynicism with which Washington has approached the issue of transferring lethal weapons to Kiev is striking. Now, by the fault of the U.S., there will be a risk for many years that innocent civilians will be blown up by submunitions that have failed. Do these civilians deserve this fate due to the U.S. desire to weaken Russia, the purported aim of the U.S. supporting Ukraine in this war? It has been described as an unprecedented restriction on people in France. Lawmakers have agreed that the country's police forces need to be allowed to spy on suspects by remotely activating the camera, microphone, and GPS of their phones and other devices. The measure agreed by lawmakers covers laptops, cars, and other connected objects, as well as phones. It further allows devices to be remotely activated to record sound and images of people allegedly suspected of terror offenses, as well as delinquency and organized crime. Rights activists have slammed the measure as, quote, an authoritarian snooper's charter. A digital rights group has slammed the provision, saying it raises serious concerns over infringements of fundamental liberties. La Quadrature du Net has called for the proposal as part of a, quote, slide into heavy-handed security. In early June, the French Senate, the upper house, approved a controversial provision to a justice bill that allowed law enforcement to eavesdrop on suspected terrorists and criminals using their devices.
The message from the top has generally been one to support the police and to reinforce their powers. And it has to be borne in mind that the police have faced some significant challenges, especially in the previous decade, where France was subjected to a series of terrorist attacks. And there was a fear that the police didn't have strong enough powers to contain that. And so some of those powers were reinforced.
Moreover, senators approved a provision in the bill allowing law enforcement to track devices' location if the owner is suspected of committing a crime. The measures come amid unprecedented protests across France over the killing of a 17-year-old boy of Algerian origin by police in late June. Nahal's killing renewed old grievances regarding police brutality and racial profiling. It is estimated that some 3,400 to 4,000 people were arrested, which included more than 1,200 minors. Most of those arrested in the recent unrest had no previous criminal record. Meanwhile, there are concerns about restrictions on social media in France. France's digital minister, Jean-Noël Barrot, has announced that from August 25th, Paris will introduce mandatory measures censoring the work of social networks in the country. According to the French minister, President Macron had urged him to, quote, put maximum pressure on social networks. Barrot has also proposed to the Senate the creation of a working group to address measures to be taken in the event of mass protests and riots. Earlier, Macron claimed that protesters were using Snapchat, TikTok, and Telegram to film violent events and to organize illegal gatherings.
Social media platforms play a significant role in the events of the past few days. We have on several of them, Snapchat, TikTok, and several others, both the organization of violent gatherings and a form of mimicking of violence, which among the youngest leads to a feeling of unreality. It sometimes feels like some of them are experiencing in the streets the video games that have intoxicated them. And this, the law, including over the past few months, has set out changes to parent control that we want to be fully respected.
Macron has also discussed the possibility of banning access to certain social media features. Macron has told about 300 local leaders that the country needs to reflect on social media use among the youngest and on the prohibitions that must be put in place. Comments drew the ire of many critics.
These incidents just keep on happening, but this time it was captured on video, and that's why people are fuming. But Macron goes to his Elton John concert, and then he blames video games for the protests. Video games! Maybe his police officers play too many video games, and that's why they pulled out their guns on a 17-year-old without a driver's license. And one of them said, I'm going to put a bullet in your head. Macron now wants to ban sensitive content on social media because it's embarrassing for him. But dare Iran ban Twitter or Egypt cut off the internet, then Macron and the West will spring into their usual chorus of that's censorship and that's a dictatorship, no freedom of speech.
French government has been accused of conducting attacks on migrants, racial profiling, and religious intolerance. Police killing has tapped into the long, festering resentment of police brutality among many French minorities and have rekindled a long, painful debate about racial profiling by police.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The United Nations has steadfastly refused to retract its strong condemnation of the Israeli regime over the Israeli military's brutal aggression against the occupied West Bank city of Jenin and its refugee camp. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Website of Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. The European Union's representative to the Palestinian territories, Sven Kuhn von Burgsdorf, has censured the Israeli regime over the proportionality of force it used during the two-day military onslaught on the West Bank city of Jenin and its refugee camp. Following the Zionist military's raid on Jenin, in which at least 12 Palestinians were martyred and approximately 100 others injured, he said, "We are concerned about the deployment of weaponry and weapon systems which questioned the proportionality of the military during the operation." One Israeli soldier was killed during the raid on Jenin. Israeli troops finally pulled back from Jenin on Tuesday evening, 4th of July, following a 44-hour-long incursion. The European envoy made the comments on Saturday as he led a delegation of United Nations officials and diplomats from 25 countries to the Jenin refugee camp. He said, "This cycle of violence has to end. It cannot continue. If there is no political solution to the conflict, we're going to stand here in a week's time, in a month's time, or in a year's time, with nothing changed." His remarks echoed United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres, who on Thursday, 6th of July, told reporters, "There was an excessive use of force by Israeli forces in its 48-hour operation, the largest that Israel has staged in the Palestinian territories since the Second Intifada of the early 2000s. Antonio Guterres also said Israeli forces had prevented the injured from receiving medical care and stopped humanitarian workers from reaching those in need. The United Nations chief, Guterres, said Israel's airstrikes and ground operations in a crowded refugee camp were the worst violence in the occupied West Bank in many years, with a significant impact on civilians. As the delegation toured the refugee camp in Jenin, residents peered out of holes left in the walls by Israeli rockets, and local authorities tested a new camp-wide alarm system to warn of future raids. The refugee camp's infrastructure was severely damaged during the Israeli onslaught. 8 kilometers of water pipes and 3 kilometers of sewage pipes were also destroyed. More than 100 houses were damaged and a number of schools were also lightly damaged, according to the United Nations. United Nations officials on Saturday, 8th of July, made a plea for funds to help rebuild the Jenin refugee camp. The Al Jazeera television network has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Zionist regime's United Nations ambassador has called on UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to retract his condemnation of Israeli forces for using excessive force and harming civilians during their devastating raid on the refugee camp in the West Bank city of Jenin. United Nations deputy spokesperson Farhan Haq responded on Friday, 7th of July, saying that Antonio Guterres had conveyed his views on Israel's operation in the Jenin refugee camp, and he stands by those words. The Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, angered by Israeli air attacks on Jenin and the danger posed to the civilian population, issued a statement on Tuesday, 4th of July, in which he said the assault had left over 100 civilians injured. Uprooted thousands of residents from the Jenin refugee camp, damaged schools and hospitals, and disrupted water and electricity networks. Antonio Guterres said Israel's airstrikes and ground operations in a crowded refugee camp were the worst violence in the West Bank in many years, with a significant impact on civilians. The Secretary General of the United Nations also criticized Israel for preventing the injured from receiving medical care and humanitarian workers from reaching those in need during the military raid, which left 12 Palestinians martyred and approximately 100 others wounded. Israel's United Nations ambassador, Gilad Erdan, called the UN chief's criticism of the Israeli military assault shameful, far-fetched, and completely detached from reality. The United Nations Security Council discussed Israel's operations in Jenin behind closed doors on Friday, 7th of July, at the request of the United Arab Emirates, and received a briefing from United Nations Assistant Secretary General Khaled Khiari. Israel's United Nations Ambassador Gilad Erdan sent a letter to the 15 Council members and Antonio Guterres before the Council meeting, in which he claimed the international community and the UN Security Council must unconditionally condemn the latest Palestinian attack and hold Palestinian leadership accountable. In a statement on Wednesday, 5th of July, three independent human rights experts said the Israeli air attacks and ground actions in Jenin amounted to egregious violations of international laws and standards on the use of force and may constitute a war crime. The United Nations Security Council took no action on Friday, 7th of July. The official website of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Organization has also covered the same story and tells us more. Secretary General of the Palestinian Resistance Movement, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad al-Nakhala, says the recent battle in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin ushered in a new era in the superiority of the resistance over the Israeli military. Ziad Nakhala made the statement in a phone conversation on Sunday, 9th of July, with the families of a number of martyrs from the deadly Israeli assault on Jenin and its refugee camp in recent days. Nakhala hailed as a great triumph for the resistance groups the Israeli regime's defeat in its recent aggression on Jenin, and stressed that the movement takes pride in every drop of blood in the latest battle. Underlining the solid will of the Palestinian people in confronting the Israeli regime, Ziad Nakhala said the victory was an extension of all the heroic battles led by the Al-Quds Brigades, the military wing of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, and other Palestinian resistance groups. He said, "What happened in the Jenin refugee camp is a great triumph in the face of Zionist aggression, led by the Jenin Battalion in the Al-Quds Brigades and all the resistance forces." Ziad Nakhala added, "What happened establishes a new era that the upper hand is for our people and their solid resistance. Nakhala also expressed gratitude to the residents of Jenin and the residents of the Jenin refugee camp in particular for their support for the resistance fighters and their combat against Israel. The English website of the Islamic Republic of Iran news agency IRNA has also covered the same story and tells us more. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has hailed the steely resistance of Palestinians in the face of Israeli military's two-day onslaught on the Jenin refugee camp, saying the occupying regime suffered a humiliating defeat in the battle for Jenin. In a tweet on Sunday, 9th of July, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani wrote that the trail of destruction left behind in the Jenin refugee camp marks a shameful moral failure for the supporters of the Israeli regime. Kanani said the war machine of the criminal Israeli regime suffered a new historic defeat in the recent brutal onslaught in Jenin. Nonetheless, he said, a much bigger defeat awaits the supporters of the Israeli regime. Nasser Kanani further underlined that the scale of destruction in the Jenin camp marks a flagrant violation of international law and constitutes a war crime. He also called on Palestinians to expose such levels of aggression to the world so that the so-called advocates of human rights would become more disgraced. Thousands of Jordanians have staged a massive rally to express their unwavering support for the Palestinian people and their resistance in the face of Israel's two-day military onslaught on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. The Jordanian demonstrators, which came from across the political spectrum, participated in the rally organized following Friday prayers in the Jordanian capital Amman to mark the victory of the Palestinians and resistance fighters in the Jenin refugee camp.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on December 17, 2008 by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran on the occasion of Eid al-Ghadir. The commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, is so highly regarded by all Muslims with regard to his knowledge, piety, and courage. In fact, all Muslims share the same opinions in regard to Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. What we Muslims have to consider today is the fact that Shia Muslims have protected this belief like their own lives over many consecutive years. Shia Muslims preserved their beliefs despite all opposition. Everyone is more or less aware of the enmity that is shown towards Shia Muslims and the pressure that has been exerted on them. Despite all these acts, Shia Muslims promoted the teachings of Shia Islam. Shia jurisprudence, or fiqh, kalam, philosophy, and civilization, as well as different sciences of Shia Islam, stand out in the history of Islam. And so do the ideas of Shia Muslims and the prominent figures of Shia Islam. Therefore, Shia Muslims have preserved their beliefs and will continue to do so in the future as well. However, You should note that such beliefs should not turn into a source of discord. This is a point which I have mentioned several times over the years and which I still emphasize.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We are aware of the enemy's intentions and the evil goals which they try to achieve through fomenting discord in the Muslims' world. They try to achieve their goals under different pretexts, such as the conflict between Shia and Sunni Muslims. By enemy, I mean the enemies of Islam and the Holy Quran. I mean those who are opposed to monotheism and the commonly held beliefs of Muslims. I do not mean those who are opposed to certain aspects of Islam. The enemies try to foment discord in the Muslims' world. They know that the unity of Muslims is harmful to them. The enemies were witness to the fact that the Islamic Revolution attracted many hearts in the Muslim world after its victory. This was all due to the grandeur of the Islamic Revolution. Even those who were not Shia Muslims were attracted to the Islamic revolutions.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
In an unexpected move, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said European countries need to pave the way for Ankara's bid to join the EU in return for the Turkish parliament approving Sweden's accession to NATO. Erdogan made the comments at the airport before heading towards Lithuania to attend the bloc's summit. Ankara has been holding off its approval for Sweden's NATO membership along with Hungary, while all other members have already approved its accession. Hungary has signaled that it will follow Erdogan's lead should he give the green light for Sweden to join the military alliance.
I'm calling here for these countries that are making Turkey wait for the door of European Union for more than 50 years. First, come and open the way for Turkey at the European Union, and then we will open the way for Sweden, just as we did for Finland.
Turkey signed a customs union agreement with the European Union in 1995 and was officially recognized as a candidate on December 1999. However, its membership bid was stalled due to what the EU said were Ankara's democratic backsliding and its dispute with the bloc member Cyprus.
I think Turkey's accession